Hello and welcome to All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy, your host for the next hour. We will be bringing you live coverage of President Obama's news conference, now scheduled for 12:20 here on 89.7 WOSU NPR News. But to get you warmed up for that, we're going to talk about some favorite reading for late winter. And Bill Eichenberger, if you're listening to this, I've been leaving you messages. Come on in. Cassie Rose, thank you very much for rearranging and arranging to be here today with us. Thank you very much. WOSU's book critic and the proprietor of the blog TheLongestChapter.com. And Kevin Griffith, professor of English poetry, writing, and all things wonderful at Capital University. Thank you. Did you get your shopping done at Kroger when you got the call?
Yes, all done.
Wonderful. Okay, very good. Let's begin with books. And the first thing I wanted to get to with the two of you was, Kevin, not 2 minutes ago you mentioned the controversial and best-selling new book about the Tiger Mother.
Yeah, the battle hymn of the Tiger Mother, Amy Chua. I believe the author's last name is Amy Chua. That was an interesting book because it got a lot of press. There was a lot of commentary about this book. And I thought it was interesting because almost all of the commentary seemed to indicate that the person had never actually read the entire book. They were just sort of referring to it in a synoptic form or something like that, a synopsis. And it made it out to be this biography or memoir of this woman who was, you know, using Chinese parenting skills on her children and who was supposed to be a model for how to be very harsh to your children. And I think that's kind of misleading. I read it. I was fascinated by it. First of all, it should be renamed Battle Hymn of the Suzuki Mother, because it's really about raising children to be great classical musicians. And I would think that anyone who's interested and has children who play violin, cello, any kind of string instrument should read this and just see what it takes. It's amazing what it takes to reach the highest level of performance as an instrumentalist in a symphony.
The Suzuki program, forgive me, begins children with instruments when they're three and four years old. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, I have a son and daughter who are in the Suzuki program. This woman, it's amazing, though, what she has to do. She drives her kids 12 hours for a special lesson from someone who's just at the top of her profession. And then that person says, you know, I'm not good enough for your child. You need to go, you know, to Boston. And then they go to Boston. It's just sort of relentless in that sense. And you get a real sense of what it takes to be the top of a profession.
That is not what comes out in the commentary. The ones, and I've read all the commentaries. I did not read the book, but they rest on that harshness of the routine. And at the end, one of the commentaries said, you know, anyone reading this book will come away and want their child to take the Suzuki, courses and stuff like that. But I walked away thinking that everybody was just, you know, converging on this woman for her harsh upbringing of the children.
Well, I think a lot of that was the media. I haven't read the book myself, but I think people went out of the way to kind of depict her as a horror show.
Right, exactly.
When she is, you know, she is setting the bar very high for her kids, and she does drive them 12 hours, and she does do what's necessary to help them meet that bar.
Exactly right. And she does. She also has some very good – it's a very witty book as well. She's very funny, and she does have some good commentary about American parenting styles. You know, she says, well, most of my friends say, oh, you should let your children find their own dreams and explore their own dreams. And she says, you know what that really means is you let your kids spend 10 hours on Facebook while you drink wine and go to yoga classes. You know, that's really funny.
Well, her daughter wrote a commentary, I believe it was in the New York Times, and, you know, saying that, you know, telling everybody sort of to quiet down, that she said that she appreciated her childhood and it wasn't too harsh, and she was in defense of her mother.
Yeah, I was wondering, first of all, I'm not sure how many children this woman has. Is it just the one daughter?
Two daughters.
And what age are they?
I believe 18 and like 16.
But she was chronicling their upbringing from the time they were really little
girls.
Right,
that's exactly right. Yeah. And she had two daughters, and the oldest one was, I hate to use these terms, but the oldest one was the successful one, the good, compliant daughter. She became an incredibly proficient violinist, performed in Budapest, that kind of thing. And it was the younger one that turns this into kind of a tragic book. The younger one really did begin to resist her mother and had a really unfortunate episode when they were in Russia. And her youngest one decides she wants to be a tennis player. That's what she really wants to do. And so her mother lets her do it, doesn't intervene, and she becomes a really skilled tennis player, college material, wins a lot of tournaments, that kind of thing. So there is, you know, there's a balance there of pushing and letting your children pursue what they want.
It demands the same kind of commitment and discipline, I would think, to be a fine athlete as it does to be a fine
musician. Exactly right.
Remind us of the title and the author.
It's called The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, Amy Chua.
So the horror stories we're hearing about Amy Chua on TV and on the blogosphere, you're not buying into it.
No, I'd say it's a much more complicated and nuanced book than that. And I would highly recommend people read it. It's a very fun read, too. It's not a long book, and she's a very witty writer, and she's a good writer. She's a professor of law at Yale, so she knows how to write.
Well, and haven't we heard some about parents in the sports arena?
Right.
You know, what about Tiger Woods' father? What about, you know, Vanessa and, you know, the tennis players?
The twins,
the twins. Yeah. I mean, you hear in the news, or we did along the way, that their parents were there, you know, pushing them, encouraging them. You know, there had to have been that harsh discipline.
I wonder if Amy Chua's daughters eventually will write a Mommy Dearest.
Yeah, probably. That's probably in the book.
Something like that.
Right. Probably in the works.
And you know there's a movie coming up out of
there.
You know there has to be. We have a call from Jerome in Marysville, whose wife was raised in Japan, which, of course, is very much in the news right now. But he was talking about piano training. Hi, Jerome. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, my wife really should probably be the one telling these stories, but she tells me about how she went through, you know, very classical, grueling piano training, and she's just totally confused by the way piano is taught in this country. And her teachers expected her to go to music school and become a pianist and piano instructor, and she chose to go to university instead. She continues to play the piano, but she has friends who were, you know, concert quality pianists who now won't even talk to you about piano.
Did she have a tiger mother?
I'm sorry. No, I don't think she did.
Okay.
She had parents who, not to that extent, but she had to practice several hours a day. And I think there's going to be a range of children who respond to this. For better or worse, there's, you know, some who my wife continues to play piano and enjoys it. She doesn't regret going to university instead of music school, but she wishes she played better. Obviously, there's some children who go on to become concert pianists and instructors, and there's some, like friends of hers who I've met, who just, you know, you put a piano in front of them and, you know, it looks like they're going to retch.
Jerome, thank you for your call.
Wait. Can I
one more thing, real fast?
Okay, real fast. You also should take a look at the pianist Tsuji, who just won the last Van Cliburn competition. He's blind, and it looks like he had a very different piano upbringing. And also, I think this book needs to be contextualized in the literature of the model Americans, which come out whenever, you know, from different minority groups trying to justify one style of being an American or another. It's really quite fascinating. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Jerome had a couple of calls there. He had a couple of topics there we could have on the art show as well. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that call. We'll be inviting more calls shortly as we continue the discussion, but I wanted to get to Cassie Rose because Cassie and Kevin and Bill Eichenberger always come in here weighted down with new books. And I'm always asking, how is it? How great is it? And I asked Cassie about a big book she held up about witches and said, was it wonderful? And she said, no! What is this book you don't like?
Well, and actually, and it's on the bestseller list, and it started out on the Washington Post bestseller list, now has hit the New York Times. It's called A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness. And my no is, it's something that I wrote about on my blog because I realized that here I did not like this book because I saw its many, many flaws, but here I know that thousands are reading it. It's a wonderful, wonderful topic about a spellbound manuscript at the Bodleian Library, and there is a woman who is a witch who does not use her witcherly powers or her sorcery powers. She wants to rely on her scholarship, and she's the one that can unbind this manuscript unbeknownst to her. Well, there's a vampire who appears at the library, and there's a romance between the two of them, and all the creatures of the world went after this woman because she has the key to this manuscript. So It's wonderful plot line, and the history here is great too, because Harkness is a professor of history. So you get, you know, Latin texts, you get, you know, the knights from the 14th century, because, you know, the vampire is 1500 years old. For me, the problem was the elementary descriptions, the romance that really was very superficial to me. I mean, you know, you've got the vampire and this woman in front of the fireplace, and he's tickling her. I mean, you know, come on. I can't get there.
Don't tickle the vampire or Cassie Rose won't like your book.
Yeah, right. But it's, you know, and it's 579 pages. And what I dealt with on the blog was this saying, I get it. I get why this is a bestseller. I get why the topics and why the reading public is going toward it. But I couldn't do it. I would read 100 pages, put it down, read another book entirely, come back to this one, read more, read another book, because I got impatient with the flaws. And I basically said, I recognize that I'm a demanding reader, and that is why, you know, I have this reaction to the book. But I also wanted to recognize that it reaches a reading public that is totally enthralled by it. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, Harkness has done, she's also jumped on the bandwagon, I have to say, about the whole vampire literature, but she's done a good job of it. But I think that critically, you know, it's very flawed.
Our producer, Amy Jurevich, wonders, why is everything about vampires on TV, movies, books, mm-hmm. everywhere? And Jeff, who answers our phones and does all the other work, says, I think the vamp phase is dying down. So depending on who you talk to, vampires are either cool or not.
Right. And I have to say one other thing that also on the blog I talked about, I made a confession, because all winter I have watched all the 7 episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So now I'm announcing it on public radio.
You really want people to know that?
And you can just go and you'll have to just read the blog and find out about that. But there's, you know, I basically invoked Joss Whedon, who was the great TV series creator, and the whole concept of why that, you know, opened my mind and took me to this book. And anyway, mm-hmm. you'll just have to read it on the blog.
Yeah. Vampires never really rang my bell, I have to say. But okay, Cassie's blog can be found at WOSU.org, all sides. We link you right to Cassie's blog, The Longest Chapter. Mm-hmm. I'm Christopher Purdy. Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic. That's one of her many hats that she wears in the literary world. And Kevin Griffith also is professor at Capital University. He is a poet. He is a teacher. He is a writer. He's a dad, and he does the family's grocery shopping, which I think is wonderful. We will be back shortly. Our number to call is 614-292-8513. You can also send us an email, allsides@wosu.org. You can find All Sides on Facebook and get to us that way. 292-8513. Let us know what you are reading. Let us know what you liked or didn't like, and we will have more discussion about books in just a moment. We're going to take a break right now.
All over the nation last Monday, powerful winds flowed from everywhere towards Iowa, strong enough to pull debris and birds right to Des Moines. The cause? The vacuum created by all the sucking up at the first 2012 presidential campaign event. I'm Peter Sagal. On the other hand, a seagull sucked in from Oregon got a tax break. Join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, tomorrow morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. And stay with 89.7 NPR News this afternoon beginning at 12:20. We'll have live coverage of President Obama's news conference.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
32 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today, a high of 41. Clouds tonight, a low of 34. All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you, our producer, Amy Jurevich. I'm Christopher Purdy, back with Kevin Griffith and Cassie Rose. And before we talk about specific books, I want to give the phone number one more time, 292-8513. But I'd like to talk about the closing of borders. which was sort of a real kind of a neighborhood. It wasn't really a neighborhood place, but it was a gathering place for a lot of people. I think more than any other of the chain bookstores that I had been to, and I'm specifically speaking on the one at Kenny Road. And I think it's a shame that they've gone out of business. Can we talk about that a little bit?
There are a lot of articles that are coming out now about the closing of bookstores. Are they, you know, all going to go away? I was mentioning to you before we came back on the air about one in The Guardian about the closing of that would used and rare bookstores be closing. And now that, you know, and Nicole Krauss writing about our bookstores going away, which means we're not going to be browsing. And the problem with that is that she was writing in this article is that while Amazon and Barnes & Noble will, you know, browse for you, they're pushing toward you what you already know and are buying. So you don't have that discovery. And like she was saying, you might be going in to the bookstore looking for Homer and you come away buying Deborah Harkness.
Or Homer, you know? Simpson.
Yeah, that's
or
right.
Homer Simpson. So it's that the browsing allows you to discover things that you normally wouldn't, and that's what we'll be losing. But I hate the fact that that articles like this are just appearing.
Yeah, I think it's a disturbing trend. Mm-hmm. I have a colleague at the law school whose wife has a manuscript, and it's being circulated by an agent. And it was interesting, on the day Borders announced that they were going bankrupt, a lot of the publishers said, no, we're not looking at manuscripts anymore. We're very concerned about the market. And what's even more disturbing, I was reading an article on poetsandwriters.org, PW.org. At one point, I can't believe this, but three of the top 50 books in the USA Today bestseller were self-published books that go directly to Kindle. And a lot of people are doing this now. They're writing their novel. You can easily turn your book into an e-book through Kindle's own software and sell it for $2.99 a book, and you keep 85% of the profits.
So the actual tangible book no longer exists.
No, yes, and that's going to be death to bookstores, I think, that kind of thing. Yeah. And then people are buying that. It's only $2.99, and I think that all three of the books that were in the top 50 were written by teens, and they were about vampires and trolls and witches and romance.
Well, that answers our question, that it's cheap, easy, and cost-effective, I guess, to do it that way.
That's fast food literature.
Well, and when you think that coming back to Borders, I mean, the publishers lost millions from this. I mean, they owe millions. I mean, you know, like Random House alone, maybe $49 million, you know, Borders owed them. So when you then say that, all right, what are the publishers going to start thinking? What if they can just push, you know, to Kindle, $2.99, all that, and just avoid the bookstores altogether? That probably looks appealing to them.
I think they're heading the same way as record stores, you know?
Yeah,
remember Tower Records?
Tower Records was my own. And as I said earlier, I put myself through school at Barnes & Noble on Fifth Avenue, New York, selling records, classical records, not CDs. That's how old I am, records. But anyway.
Amazing.
That's a different story. And Amy also makes the point that Barnes & Noble was ready to compete with the Nook and the Nook Color, but Borders didn't have that ready yet. They were not really that they couldn't invest any further because it was just, you know, a bad time. 292-8513 if you want to elevate the conversation away from bankruptcy and talk about books and reading and literature, all sides at WOSU.org. Kevin, what do you have to recommend for us?
Well, I have a really great brand new book of poetry. Let's talk about poetry. That's interesting. It's called Give Over Gray Malkin. Give Over Gray Malkin, that's from Macbeth. And it's by Gaylord Brewer, a poet I knew in graduate school who has gone on to much bigger and better things. This is his eighth book. It's a wonderful book. A lot of the poems in here are about the death of his dog. His dog, which was very important to him, died several years ago. I'd like to read a little bit of this poem called Jasper. And it's about him seeing a vision of his dog in a dream. His dog comes back to him in a dream. Here's the last part of the poem. Before I woke and left, you stood for me, still brave within your pain. You knew what I wanted, to take up your body to mine, to walk holding tight until we reached the living room where your mother waited just for us.
Oh.
That's just a beautiful book about... you know, getting over grief, traveling, being a human being. It's called Give Over Gray Malkin. Many funny poems in the book as well. And it's published by Red Hen Press. Red Hen Press is a really big, highly successful press on the West Coast. Red Hen Press published mostly poetry. So I'd highly recommend it.
And how about one more?
One more?
From Kevin.
I'll read you the very first one here. After, what did they portend? The commotion and hunger, the overnight trains twisted in hot sheets, what the late arrivals and the taxis, always a taxi, bartered and argued, dim light for the best in those dim rooms. They caged the cold in winter, heat in summer. What was the tally, bills exchanged, counting to waiting palms, money lost in another dirty stack, extracted somehow. Enough to get by, get along. So you got by, got along, is that it? How did they accrue the handshakes, the confidences? It's a Gaylord Brewer, excellent, excellent book of poetry, and it just came out.
Sounds
this
like a
month.
Great book.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It does. It's moody, and all, there's a lot, sounds like a lot of variety in just the two poems you read to us. Scott from Columbus is on the line. He is recommending a book by Steve Barry. Hi, Scott, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, The Alexandria Link is fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I read about 2 years ago. If you like Dan Brown, it's along the same kind of themes, but it's really good. And then at the end of the book, it'll go through and tell you, you know, everything that's fact, everything that's fiction, everything that he put a spin on. There's several of them after that, and they feature a character named Totten Malone. And I just love that they're so much fun to read.
You know, that's a good point of getting to the end of a book and the author clarifying what's fact, what's fiction, what they took a spin on. Because that's always been my question with historical fiction. If I don't know the history of the time, and then I get to the end of the book and I wonder, well, what was real and what wasn't?
Mm-hmm. And Scott recommends Alexandria Link by Steve Barry. Is this part of a series, Scott?
Yeah. It starts with The Templar Legacy is the first one featuring Cotton Malone. And then it goes The Alexandria Link, The Venetian Betrayal, goodness.
Well, that's a good start. That's a good start.
I'm currently reading The Emperor's Tomb right now. So, it's really good so far, too. So,
Scott, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. 292-8513 if you have a book to recommend for us or you'd like to know more about what's out there. AllSides@WOSU.org. You can also reach us on Facebook at All Sides. Cassie Rose, give us a recommendation.
Well, one of the best books that I have read in the past couple months, it's up for an Edgar nomination for Best Novel. It's called Crooked Letter by Tom Franklin. And it is this wonderful combination of a literary novel and a mystery, great sense of place, which is rural Mississippi, and great character development. And it's about two young boys, one African-American and one white, and they're in poor rural Mississippi, and they have a brief friendship in their childhood. And then it's broken up by probably, I would say, betrayal and also some prejudicial behavior. But what happens to one of them, his name is Larry Ott, is it a local girl asks him to take her to the movie theater, which he does. He's all excited about it. But once they get in the car, she says to him, no, I'm going to have you take me somewhere else. And she realizes she's using him so that she can go see her boyfriend. Well, what happens that night is that she never comes home. And so everybody accuses or thinks that Larry has done something with her. But he's never convicted, accused, or they can't find the body. Well, 25 years later, then, we come to this book, and his friend is back in town. His friend is Silas 32 Jones. He was a great baseball player. He's the what they call the constable in the town. And at this point in time, the Rutherford girl is missing. She is a daughter of the big lumber mill owner in town. So, of course, everybody thinks Crazy Larry might have something to do with it. So there's that going on. Then there's a drug dealer who is, you know, shows up missing and dead in the woods and all this. And it's a very layered mystery. And what you come away with is this relationship of the two boys and the two men, a lot of moral issues that are there that make you sit back and think, what would I have done in this situation? And it's the mystery keeps you going, the rural Mississippi atmosphere. You can just sort of feel the kudzu just crawling all over, you know, the houses. And the poverty and the way of life. It's really a well-written book. And I read it at the library with a library book. It had was on a 14-day book and had a long line of waiting list for it. It's very, very well written, very involving, and it's just a great, great story. I highly recommend
it. Title and author one more time.
It's called Crooked Letter by Tom Franklin.
We have a lot of people on hold with calls. I'm just waiting to get a little more information before we start taking calls. So briefly, I'm just curious if anybody has read The Paris Wife.
No, that's the Hemingway
right.
book.
That's on my table right now. It's a new novel, historical fiction, mm-hmm. I guess you'd call it, based on Hadley Hemingway, the author's first wife. Mm-hmm. And it's very Paris in the 20s. And apparently she was entrusted with a suitcase full of his work, which she left on a train in Paris, and he never saw it again.
Oh.
And that sort of that was a horrible moment for them. The marriage did not last. He, in fact, took off with one of her girlfriends. So, yes,
okay.
That was his second wife. But that's been very much the news right now. We have a call from Sam in Bluffton who wants to recommend some mysteries. Hi, Sam. Are you there?
Yeah, hi. They're both written by Jed Rubenfeld, who happens to be the husband of Amy Chu. He's a teacher, a law professor at Yale. Mm-hmm. Both of them involve Carl Jung and what's his name? The other psychiatrist.
Freud.
Both at the turn of the century, both in the same place, Boston and New York. The central character is a young doctor who's a protege of Sigmund Freud, but they're extremely well written, and even though they have, I think, quite a few characters, they just manage to, they don't jumble them up. But more importantly, what you were just talking about, at the end of the book, he goes into four or five or six pages of what was fact and what was fiction in the book. And it's just, and it makes it all that much better, but they're extremely well written.
Jed Rubenfeld, right? Is that his name?
That's his name.
Sam, thanks so much for the recommendation. I appreciate the call. Thank you. Kevin, here's a call for you from Connie in Lancaster. She wants to talk about poetry reading groups. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'd just like to comment and tie together the poetry and the closing of borders. I am too sad about that. I was sad when Nickleby's closed.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And I'm in two poetry groups, so a local group here in my community where we get together once a month and we read a poet that we like, and then we read something of our own work. And then I'm also participate in the Firelands Writing College at Bowling Green, where they have an annual writers, they call it the Island Writers Retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've been noticing is within these small groups, you have the liveliness and the camaraderie and let's have a cup of tea or coffee talk like you used to have in some of these small independent bookstores. And so while the big giant bookstores are, I think someone made the comment, guiding us to places to read what they want to sell, so to speak, I see these little groups emerging that are very eclectic, and they're sort of replacing that activity for me, and you just sort of have to hunt for them. But I just wanted to share that comment regarding that. And as far as poetry goes, I just have to put a plug in for Billy Collins because I love all this stuff.
Connie, thanks so much for your call.
Billy has a new book coming out, too, in April.
Yeah. And he's coming to Bexley April 20th. He's going to be reading in Bexley, so keep that in mind. April 20th.
April
Billy
20th,
Collins.
Write that down. Mm-hmm. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend. We're talking about books today with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. We have people waiting calls. Thank you for these calls. We do ask that you keep it rather brief so that we can accommodate everybody. This is Lucas from Columbus. Hi, Lucas.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to suggest a graphic novel that's been around for quite a while now, and it kind of really comes into play with all these, revolutions in the Arab world. Persepolis is something that I've always enjoyed.
I never saw that. That was a movie, too. Didn't they make that into a film?
I think they did actually make that into a movie, but it's definitely my girlfriend actually teaches a course at OSU, and she uses Persepolis sometimes to discuss women's feelings about war and revolution and the Arab world. And it's a really amazing biographical story, and it goes along really well with the whole idea of the historical fiction, and sort of gives you a background to a little bit of what's going on anyway in Iran specifically, but with the revolution. But it's a very interesting graphic novel and really, really well done.
The graphic novel Persepolis was, I think it was an animated film
the last couple of years ago
that I think it won an Oscar for best. Mm-hmm. It was very, very well received. Thank you so much, Lucas, for your recommendation. I appreciate the call. Kevin, can you just, or Cassie, can you briefly, because we've talked about graphic novels on this program before, and there's a lot of interest in them. Thumbnail, quickly, what's a graphic novel? How is it different than another novel, another kind of novel?
Well, and I have to say that I love the fact that graphic novels are getting a lot of respect now in the media. They're being covered, they're being reviewed, because there are some wonderful ones coming out, and I've read several of them. My mind is blanking on them, but it's a combination of the graphic, which can be, some may call it comics, but it's versus the words and how your mind, or how it tells the story between the two. So it's not just, you know, a picture with a caption. You have to see, you know, both together to understand the story, and you come away from it with that emotional combination. So it's the words and the graphics that work together to tell the story.
The best one I've read lately, I was going to bring it on this show at one point, but it's called, I believe it's called Go Down in Darkness, and it's the biography of Johnny Cash in graphic novel form. It's fantastic. You learn a lot about Johnny Cash, and you can really, through the visuals, get a sense of the anguish he went through at a certain points in his career, and what he had to go, and the introspection he had to go through at times. It's very well done.
Mm-hmm. But as you say, graphic novels seem to be finally getting some respect and some attention out there. My daughter's a devotee, so they're all over my house as well. We're going to take a break for 90 seconds and come back for more of All Sides Weekend Books with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. We have a couple of people on hold. We'll get to you as soon as we can. 292-8513. Don't go away.
I'm General Manager Tom Ryland, and WOSU is proud to participate in the 170 Million Americans for Public Broadcasting campaign. It's an unprecedented collaboration of public stations, listeners, and viewers throughout the country. To ensure the quality news and classical music you love continues to receive critical federal support, go to the website 170millionamericans.org and join the campaign. Thank you.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. And Sunday evening on WOSU-TV, celebrate 25 years of Les Miserables as a company of more than 300 actors and musicians perform together on one stage. Watch the Les Miserables 25th Anniversary Concert. It's Sunday evening beginning at 6 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Ohio State's Comprehensive Cancer Center, rated exceptional by the National Cancer Institute. More information about Ohio State's Comprehensive Cancer Center is at cancer.osu.edu.
32 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today, a high of 41. Clouds tonight, a low of 34 degrees. Partly sunny for Saturday, a high of 53. A few clouds Saturday night and a low of 32. And looking ahead to Sunday, some sunshine and a high of 45. All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're back. Thank you, Amy Jurevich. I want to get to a call from Luann in Westerville, because she had a comment about that there is hope for bookstores. So I really want to talk about that. Hi, Luann. Luann?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, I will miss Borders tremendously, but there's nothing like cuddling up to a good book. And as much as Kindles are wonderful, and I learned about the $2.99 kind of thing, self-publishing and stuff like that, I just really feel that people will hang on to books. Sort of like when television came out and radio was in danger. I don't know what your thoughts are, but maybe books.
Thank
have God. Yeah, no kidding. Maybe books will have to reinvent themselves a little bit.
And that might not be a bad thing, huh? If they did that?
Right.
Reinvented those. Any comments about that? Are you guys hopeful about the continued availability of books, of physical objects and things like that? Yeah. And do you think it's important? I mean,
Yeah, I think what she said is right. I think some publishers are already doing that, that, okay, if it's a book, you've got to give me a little more visual appeal, right. A little bit more interesting cover designs, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. It'll force the book to become more of a work of art. Mm-hmm. And the books that are merely disposable, sort of junk food books, which mm-hmm. we like to read, romances, vampire mm-hmm. novels, they'll go
Dominic
the way...
Dunn.
Yeah, Dominic Dunn. They'll go the way of the Kindle, and that's a good use for the Kindle, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. But I think the question mark, though, is the upcoming generations, because those that are going through school now, elementary, high school, they're a technological youth, and will they want the hardbound book? That's the question mark, is that what is changing over and what they're being trained toward. Like when we grew up, we were the TV, so yes, we listened to the radio, but our parents, gathered around the radio at night like we gather around the TV. Nothing went away, but there is a transformation in that. There is that question mark about the next generation, yeah. their relationship to books.
When I was a kid, it was a big deal to get an electric typewriter.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a big event. That was kind of a big deal. Anna Marie in Worthington has a recommendation for us. Hi there.
It is the Illuminated Rumi. And speaking of books as art, it's an exquisite book. And it's co-authored by Coleman Box, who is the known translator for Rumi's works. Rumi was a 13th century poet from Afghanistan, which I find also very interesting. But I have cherished this book. I'm an art collector, and it is one of my treasured acquisitions of the moment.
I know my daughter has that book and loves it.
So that's great. I have it too. Yeah, Jalaluddin Rumi. Rumi is just very big.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Anna Marie, for the recommendation. I appreciate the call. 292-8513. We do now have a couple of lines open. Thank you very much for all these calls. Again, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have Gary from Columbus who has a recommendation for us. Hi, Gary. Are you there?
I am here.
Go ahead.
I wanted to tell you quickly about She Looks Just Like You, which is a memoir of non-biological lesbian motherhood for women and for men who are going to be fathers. The author has Ohio roots. Her name is Amy Miller. The other book that I wanted to mention was The Bells by Richard Harvell, which is his first novel. Takes place in the 1600s, well-written, interesting. And then finally, I wanted to mention Indie Books, which is a great source for book lists, which are contemporary, and it's available on the Internet. And I mourn not so much the big box bookstores going the way of all things, but the independent bookstores.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, but don't you think that there's a possibility that they might come back? I mean, think about this in terms of everybody, when everybody moved out to the suburbs and they, left the big old houses in the middle of the city. Now everybody's coming back to the big old houses in
the
city.
Oh, might it be so?
But, yes, that's my wish.
The big box bookstores have been instrumental in driving out the indies. But, it's a rough way to go, just like opening a small restaurant. And I think of the bookstore, and geez, I can't remember the name, but in St. Paul, Minnesota, that was connected to McAllister.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough way to go, but I feel sorry for them.
Well, and they may only be able to make it in the big cities. I mean, New York City has Partners in Crime. They have Three Lives and Company.
I want to ask you about that. Gary, thank you for your call. Cassie, you just came back from a trip recently to New York City, but you were mentioning a number of indie bookstores.
Yes.
I lived there years ago, and I was delighted and surprised to hear from you that these stores are still there. Three Lives.
Mm-hmm. Three Lives and Company. And right around the corner from it was a cookbook store. And there was, and as I said, you know, Partners in Crime, which was, that's where I got introduced. I had a wonderful conversation with the bookstore owner, and he got me started on some of the crime writers and their first books and how to get going, which is what you miss from the big box stores. He was able to guide me and give me recommendations on where to start on a genre that I'm not familiar with. Three Lives and Company, walked in there, the tables
beautiful,
had,
yeah.
They were beautiful, and they had wonderful authors from the bestsellers to also, you know, Scott Bradfield's, you know, book that came out from $2 Radio. I was thrilled to see that on their table. And again, you can talk with them, and they can give you the recommendations of, you know, what to find. I was there trying to, I think, find a book of, I forget, there was another crime author, and I was trying to find the first one, and they were scurrying around and trying to help me. The atmosphere is there, the connection is there, and what happens then is that you go back in, and they'll say, you know, boy, this has come in, you know, would you be interested in it? And you develop a relationship, and it's, I'm not so sure that those can't come back.
Here's a question I'm trying to think, and I can't, about, are there any indie bookstores left in our listening area that aren't used bookstores?
Oh, no. I was thinking of Karen Wycliffe.
Yeah, which is a great store. I mean, it's a wonderful store. But that, you know, that's not really specialized or antique books or used books. Is there one indie bookstore that you can think
of? Yes, cover to cover.
Oh, the children's books.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
cover to cover.
Right,
that's a great store.
Yeah,
that's right near Karen Wycliffe's, just north of North Broadway there. I'd recommend that on High Street. And they'll do that, too. You can go in and say, I need a book for a sixth grader. You know, what do you have here? What can you recommend? They're very good about
that's cover
to cover, but that's children's books. But still, they're trying.
Yeah. Well, and I think that then you can look at the used bookstores, like Acorn Bookshop in Grandview,
beautiful.
Where it's, you may want a book that has just been out for a year, so it's sort of still new, and they may have a copy of it, actually, because someone has read it and turned it over.
Let's get to some calls. We have four people on hold, so I'll get to you as quickly as I can, and more coming. But here's Jennifer in New Albany, who has a comment about books becoming like CDs. Hi, Jennifer.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, hi, everybody.
Hi. You're on, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Well, what did you want me to go ahead with? I'm sorry. I had a conversation earlier with someone. Oh, my opinion about...
Right. I mean, you know, you're on. It says books becoming like CDs. Is that something you wanted to talk about?
Well, I was just saying, you know, my perspective about kids and how books are going to relate to our future generations as, you know, the Kindles and what you were saying becomes more popular. And then the last caller was talking about, you know, one of her favorite acquisitions being this beautiful book and the value of it because she's a collector. And I was just thinking that that's what these books are going to be to our future generations, for those of us that appreciate antiques already. I mean, you know, you have some favorite things that were made way back when, and you know, they're just precious because they don't make them anymore, you know?
Jennifer, thanks so much for your call. I've got to move on with other callers, but I appreciate your waiting and your comments. Thank you very much. Okay, George is on the line from Howard, Ohio, who recommends an author called Joe Sacco. That's a name new to me. Oh, Kevin's nodding excitedly. Hi, Joe. George, are you there?
Yeah, good afternoon, or almost afternoon.
Yeah.
I wanted to recommend Joe Sacco. It's like Sacco and Vanzetti, S-A-C-C-O. Joe Sacco is a graphic artist. I discovered him at the local library. His book was in the young adult section, but I tried to talk the librarian to moving into the adult section because this is really a novel for people who want to become mature. And
oh, dear.
Even if they are adults, they can still work on it.
Right.
And it's wonderfully illustrated. It is a graphic novel, and it puts you right on the street and in the homes of the people in Palestine. The title is Palestine, and if you want to know or gain any insight on things that are happening in the Middle East, I'd recommend this book to everybody. It's really an enjoyable read. It's entertaining, and it's highly informative. Like I say, you're right there with the people. It's well done, and I think all of Joe Sacco's books are actually for all age groups, but I think adults particularly as who he addresses them to. They're very informative, and most of them have a political orientation. One of them was, I think, called Graza. It was about the war there. He's recently written something on class consciousness, and I can't remember the title. But if you're interested in graphic novels, Joe Sacco is it.
Thank you so much, George. I appreciate the recommendation. I'm going to check that out myself and maybe see if I can take something. And, Kevin, you had some recognition when Joe Sacco's name
No, I
was
just
mentioned.
Remembered. Palestine is an excellent book.
Yeah.
And, it's been around for several years. You should easily be able to find it at a library.
Stephanie is on the line from Cincinnati to talk about Ohio bookstores. Hi, Stephanie.
Yes. Down here in Cincinnati, there is now it does also deal with used books, but it's called the Ohio Bookstore, and they also publish books that are of local interest, things about Cincinnati during the Civil War, that kind of thing. So they actually publish things that are first run and that only they would be sponsoring and so forth. But, you know, worthwhile, serious books that they're issuing. But they also have, you could get new books from them as well as used. And that's down here in Cincinnati. And it's a very unusual type thing where they actually issue books themselves. And the other thing, just as a quick reference to the graphic novels, years ago in the 1960s, there was something called Classics Illustrated, which basically kind of a comic book format, but it was based on great books to get children that were, you know, 8, 10, you know, 12 years old used to some of the plot outlines and the characters and some of the really great fiction of the Western world. So there were some.
I remember those very well.
They still exist.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you can get them in hardcover form at the library. Yeah.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. But I remember seeing those, and they were beautifully done. They were very well done.
The Ohio Bookstore in Cincinnati. Do you know roughly where it is in Cincinnati, Stephanie?
Oh, darn.
Well, we'll look online. We'll find it.
Let's see. It's in downtown.
Okay.
Maybe. I'm not sure if it's on Main Street or.
Well, I'll look online because I'm going to post that later on our website. I thank you very much for the call. I appreciate that. 292-8513 is the number to call. We have a few minutes left. This is All Sides Weekend Books with Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic and the chatelaine of the blog, thelongestchapter.com, and Kevin Griffith, professor of what's your actual title? Professor of
English.
English. I just make it easy. Why not? at Capital University. He's also a poet, a teacher, a writer, and a good neighbor. And we have a call from David who's wondering about, I guess, Rizzoli in New York. Hi, David. Are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I have a question. Rizzoli Bookstore used to have several across the country, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco. Do they hit any more?
I believe they do in New York because I remember when I was going through the list of bookstores to go to during my visit that was there, but I chose not to go
that
there.
That was a great bookstore back in the day. It was on Fifth Avenue and then moved to East 57th Street.
Okay.
I don't know if it's still there or not, but I guess it probably is.
Well, I'm wondering if because they published beautiful books, too. They were so.
Yeah. That might be a way to go for these indie bookstores if they start publishing as well as selling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You think that's a trend
I just
coming?
Think of like $2 Radio. That's a great local independent publisher. There are a lot of good independent publishers.
Yes.
That's a great area. That is booming. So.
Yes, it is.
We have an email from James who recommends Sylvia Plath's Winter Trees. And he says, of course, if you want something less dreary, you can read Sylvia Plath's Crossing the Water. I know a little bit about Sylvia Plath, but I don't know these two titles, so clearly I don't know enough. Kevin?
Those are her later books, posthumously published.
Are they novels?
No. They're books of poetry that came out after her death. And if my recommendation would just be to get the collected poems of Sylvia Plath, and that would encompass those two books, I believe. So.
We've also had a number of callers recommending the Book Loft in German Village as their favorite bookstore.
Yes.
I don't know how I forgot that.
Yes.
That's a feast to go in there and browse and look around. There's another one in Linworth in the church.
The Village.
Village.
Yeah,
yes,
Village.
It's also a wonderful bookstore. So we're doing okay, but I think there's always room for a – you know, remember the Grolier in Harvard Square? Mm-hmm. Did you know that bookstore? It was all poetry. It was literally a corner. I mean, it was six people couldn't fit in there, but it was I'm in one of my Sylvia Beach moods. You know?
Well, City Lights. You could go there in San Francisco, and they had a beautiful room of poetry.
Yeah, that's a great bookstore.
We have a call from Helene in Bexley who wants to talk about The Invisible Bridge. Hello, Helene.
This is a new author. Her name is Julie Oringer. It's a beautifully written book. Takes place in Hungary, in Paris, starting in the 30s. It concerns one family, mostly three brothers, and takes you from just before World War II, during World War II. She writes beautifully. These are three Hungarian Jewish brothers. One was in architecture school in Paris. One was in medical school in Italy. And they end up having to go back to Hungary because it does have all the horrors of war and what the terrible things that happen, but it's so beautifully written, and she just has a marvelous way with words. You can get a description in three words that you can picture. An excellent author.
Thank you so much, Helene, for the recommendation of The Invisible Bridge. I appreciate the call very much.
Thank you.
And Scott from Columbus is here to recommend an author for us. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody's familiar with Jean Owl, who wrote the Earth Children series. I've heard a rumor, and I don't know, maybe one of the guests can confirm it, that what she's saying is the final book in the series is coming out the end of this month, which is pretty exciting news for me, and I wondered if anybody knew if that's actually true or not.
How are you spelling her last name, Scott?
A-U-E-L.
Jane Owl.
Clan of the Cave Bears.
Yeah, that's right.
Cave Bears, of course. Yes.
I don't follow her, so I don't know if her last book is coming out. What you can do, though, is to go to her publisher's website. That's where you'd probably get the official word on that.
Just do a Google search on her name.
I recommend her anyway. If you haven't read that series, I'm not normally a series kind of person, but and some of them are better than others. There are four initially, but especially the first one and the last one so far, which was Clan of the Cave Bear and Mammoth Hunter, are excellent, excellent books, and there's wonderful entertainment. And there's also some historical information in them, so they're very interesting.
Thank you so much, Scott, for your call. I appreciate it. Clan of the Cave Bear was a huge seller at one point, wasn't it? That was a very popular book a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. We have about 2 minutes left, so in our last 90 seconds, I want each of you to give us one more recommendation. Cassie Rose.
I will give you two, actually, because they're both two collections of short stories, one called Light Lifting by Alexander McLeod. Very good short stories. I won't go into description about them, but Indie Press, Biblioasis, keep your eye open for that. Another collection, You Know When the Men Are Gone by Siobhan, I don't know if I'm saying her name right, Fallon, F-A-L-L-O-N.
Siobhan
Fallon, thank you. You Know When the Men Are Gone. She is the wife of a soldier who's been deployed to Iraq for two times and has lived at Fort Hood, Texas. And her stories are about the women and the families at Fort Hood that are left behind when the soldiers are in Iraq.
I'll look for that book, but
it's very, very good.
It must ring really true.
It does, and she does a good job of staying in the middle ground. There are no bad people here. There are no heroes. It's very realistic.
And Kevin.
A recommendation with reservations, autobiography of Mark Twain.
Oh, yes.
A really surprising bestseller. And I received this book as a birthday gift. And it's, first of all, the book is as large as an end table. It could serve as an end table. But just a warning, if you get this, this is not a continuous narrative. It's about 1,000 pages long, and only about 200 are the actual autobiography of Mark Twain. And even that is broken up into sections. But it's fascinating. And just a quick fact, when he first started writing, he called himself Max Swain. That was interesting.
Oh,
I didn't know that. That used to
yes.
be his pen name when he started writing articles for Harper's. So
the things you learn.
Yeah.
I thank you both, Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith, for coming in today. I thank everybody for listening and for all the calls. I'm sorry we couldn't get to everyone. I'm Christopher Purdy for All Sides Weekend Books. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Radio. Media.